Support for PrairiePublic is provided by North Dakota Horizons, North Dakota's state magazine. For more than 50 years, the quarterly publication has been celebrating North Dakota's great people, places, food, events, and history. Subscriptions available at ndhorizons.com.
Welcome to Tuesday and Tuesday's edition of Main Street right here on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein, your host. In the second half today, we're excited to welcome back Brian Freeman, a master storyteller known for blending suspense and deep character exploration in his writing. He'll be discussing his latest thriller, Break Every Rule, a novel that combines the thrill of his Jason Bourne series with the raw realism of his Jonathan Stride books. Brian will be in conversation with my former colleague, Ashley Thornburg. But first, we're focusing on a vital community issue. As National Suicide Prevention Month continues, Main Street takes you inside the Fargo VA healthcare system. They've just broken ground on a new mental health building, which is a significant step in supporting our veterans. We'll discuss the impact of this development and broader efforts to combat suicide. Joining me in conversation are Dr. Teresa M. Holt, Associate Chief of Staff for Mental Health, Sarah Kemp Talbot, she's a Coordinator of Communication Engagement and Partnerships, and Sean Abbas, Public Affairs Officer at the Fargo VA. Dr. M. Holt, welcome to Main Street.
Thank you. It's great to be here today.
And Sarah Kemp Talbot, welcome to Main Street.
Thank you. It's an honor to be here.
And Sean Abbas, welcome to Main Street.
Thank you for having me again. It's my second time driving down this street.
This is a good street to be on, but it's a tough topic we're talking about today. And Dr. Imhold, I want to visit with you first. The Fargo VA just had a groundbreaking for a new mental health facility, which is exciting, but why is it necessary?
So the need for a new building really has to do with the fact that here at the Fargo VA, we've expanded out services. And we've expanded the number of staff that we have and the number of services that we offer. And we've really run out of space in our current footprint. And so additional space will allow us to continue to expand out the services that we currently have, as well as potentially add some new services in the future.
And for our listeners, those who may wonder, what are those services? What is available here for veterans in this state?
Yeah, we have so many different services under mental health. So our one level of care would be within our primary care clinics. Another level of care is what we call general mental health. And those are conducted through our BHIP teams, or Behavioral Health Interdisciplinary Program teams. And our BHIP teams really focus on making sure that a veteran who's receiving mental health service has a team-based approach to care. So the teams include a psychiatrist, a psychologist, therapists, social workers, case managers, nurses, pharmacy, to make sure that there's wraparound services for somebody within that level of care. And then we also have some specialty services, including substance use treatment and specialty PTSD treatment.
So if I'm listening, I may have thought, okay, she just listed five or six things I could take advantage of, but I'm not making five trips
Absolutely.
To the place. What would you tell that person?
I would say, give us a call. Call our mental health department, set up an appointment. We can walk you through. It's not expected that a veteran or a family member would know what exactly somebody needs or what services we all have available. So by meeting with one of our mental health professionals, we can walk you down that road. We can provide guidance on different options that are available here at the VA.
One of the mantras that I heard growing up in the West and that I still think plays today is, I don't need help. I can get through this on my own. I can get out of bed every morning and figure it out, I guess. People need help.
Absolutely. And there's still so much of that stigma here in North Dakota, northern Minnesota, where people think, I don't really need mental health treatment. I can get through this. It's that, you know, pull yourself up by your bootstraps type of thing. And the reality is that, yeah, that may work for a while, but some of the challenges that people have, especially veterans, when they come back to civilian life or when they're no longer on a deployment, it makes sense for you to kind of struggle with that transition back sometimes. These mental health issues have existed for a long time. They just looked different. Over time, you know, they called it shell shock in World War II. During Vietnam, we had lots of people coming back with PTSD. Those things are still there. And so we can provide treatment even if it's been 40, 50 years.
And I think
years.
That's key. Within a household, perhaps, we've noticed that mom or we've noticed that dad or grandpa or grandma is really starting to maybe act a little different. Those could be related to things that happened a long time ago.
Absolutely.
And care is worth seeking.
Absolutely. And one thing that we've even noticed is people who served in Vietnam, when they retire, they start to have challenges that they didn't have when they were working and raising a family and involved in the community. Now they have time on their hands and they start thinking about things that they hadn't thought about in many, many years. And we have services for everyone.
Sarah, your role is to make sure people know about these services. What do you tell them and how do you tell them?
What we first refer folks to, especially veterans, is 988. So if you're a veteran or in crisis or you're concerned about a veteran in crisis, we encourage them to contact the Veterans Crisis Line to receive 24/7 confidential support. People don't have to be enrolled in VA care or in healthcare benefits to connect with the Veterans Crisis Line. They can reach responders by dialing 988 and pressing 1. Or chatting online at veteranscrisisline.net or texting 838-255.
When somebody dials 988 for the first time, what are they going to hear on that other end? Because that would be a scary call to make, I think, for many, whether you're supporting someone in crisis or in crisis yourself.
Well, everybody who calls 988 and presses 1 and to get the Veterans Crisis Line will be connected with a trained crisis responder that is employed by VA. So you can rest assured that that person not only is well trained in services for veterans and about veterans, but potentially a veteran themselves. They also have a team of people helping them should a crisis arise. So it's not always just a one-to-one conversation. There are other ways that people can get help as well.
Dr. Imholt, give me an idea of the number of folks the Fargo VA is helping now with mental health issues. I think that number may surprise folks.
Yeah, believe it or not, it's about 13,000 a year. 13,000 veterans, again, across North Dakota and Northern Minnesota, come to the Fargo VA or one of our clinics, our community-based outpatient clinics, for mental health treatment. In addition, we're able to provide virtual care. So let's say somebody lives 2 hours from the nearest clinic, we can actually provide virtual care to that person. And so you can get somebody who is trained in working with veterans to receive mental health treatment, whether it's medication, whether it's therapy. You can get somebody at the VA no matter where you live here in North Dakota.
And when you say virtual care, what is that?
Our virtual care options include what we call VVC or virtual video care. It's either done on an iPad or a laptop or even your cell phone. And it provides face-to-face virtual care to that person. If the veteran is unable to obtain a cell phone or doesn't have great service, we can also provide a VA-issued iPad to that individual. And the individual can participate in treatment through an iPad.
Sean, you had a groundbreaking for the facility last week.
We did.
What happened and what was the reception from the community?
The reception from the community was actually quite great. We had a judge from one of the veteran treatment courts that we're trying to get set up here actually come and attend as well, which was a great thing to let everybody know that the community plays a role in this, and it was very well received. It's one of the things that we just tried to tell people was that it's not necessarily mental health as far as like inpatient, it's mental wellness, and there's outpatient options available for veterans to participate in, and it's not necessarily just they need to participate in their wellness, overall wellness, their whole health, and mental wellness plays a key role in that.
Sarah, we were talking off mic that we know the numbers of veterans who are served, but there are lots of veterans out there who aren't part of the system yet that might need services.
So annually, the VA comes out with a suicide annual report. And the last one came out in 2023. We know that over half of veterans who die by suicide are either not enrolled in VA or haven't been seen by VA healthcare in the past 2 years. So those are veterans that are in our communities. They're going to our churches. They are in our service clubs. They're going to our bars. They're veterans that you know and love. And so part of my role as community engagement and partnership coordinator is to engage with communities to help them identify how they can prevent suicide in their communities. So for some communities, that might look like breaking down stigma and encouraging folks to get help. And in other communities, they might feel like they're beyond that and they need to start building up their mental health care in their communities.
Sarah, I came from Wyoming. Mm-hmm. Wyoming has incredibly high, maybe the highest in the country, rates of suicide. Most horrible thing to be the leader of in anything. Mm-hmm. But North Dakota is a close second. Why is that?
Well, suicide is multifactorial. There's no one reason for suicide. There's always multiple circumstances that we can look at when someone dies by suicide. But in North Dakota, we have some unique challenges. One of them is rurality. Many people live in rural or frontier areas where access to care is very difficult. Even though they might have telehealth, that their internet connection might not be great. Even though they might be 20 miles from the nearest clinic, there might not be a mental health provider available at that clinic. So that's a second problem that we have in North Dakota, is that we have a limited number of mental health providers in our state. So not everybody has immediate access to mental health care. And I'm talking generally, not just veterans.
Yeah, can I interrupt right there? Because mm-hmm. I think what I'm hearing is that's not the case for veterans if they want to make that first call. Am I right about that?
Yes. I would say we're going to do, at the Fargo VA, we're going to do the best we can to get them in to see a mental health provider as soon as possible. But again, there are many veterans and lots of others in the community who don't use VA, choose not to use VA, have never enrolled, have thought that they don't qualify, so haven't gone down that road yet.
What's your message to them right now? What would you like to tell them?
If it's a veteran and they think they don't qualify, or they think that they would rather not, they'd rather save the services for some other veteran, we hear that quite a bit. I don't need it, somebody needs it more than me, is to call us. We'd love to see if we can get you enrolled. We'd love to see if we can find you a service, whether that's mental health or primary care or whatever works best for you. We'd love to help you find primary care, mental health, other specialty services here at the VA that you might qualify for. And in addition, if you don't qualify for VA for whatever reason, or choose not to use VA for whatever reason, we still encourage you to reach out for help. There are primary care providers and mental health providers within the state that would love to see you and love to help you.
I would say, just from veteran to veteran, I would say give us a try, because there's so many different services and programs that the VA offers that it's hard to list like the whole laundry list. So give us a try, and maybe there's something in there that works for you, and maybe it would find out what will help you. We have so many veterans come in here and like, man, I wish I knew about that before, mm-hmm. Before I came in here. Additionally, we have psychologists at some of our clinics that aren't necessarily in Fargo that veterans might not know about. I know Bemidji.
We have mental health providers at all but two of our community-based outpatient clinics, and we can provide virtual care to that clinic that we don't have a mental health provider. The only two clinics that we do not have an on-site mental health provider are Grafton and Devil's Lake.
But that virtual option is absolutely available.
100%. The virtual option is available either from the clinic itself, or again, from the convenience of somebody's home.
Dr. Imholt, I think that's an important point. Maybe someone doesn't want to go out in public, doesn't want to go to the clinic, doesn't want to be seen mm-hmm. walking in the front doors. Home is an option here.
Absolutely. And a lot of people think at first, I'm not so sure about this virtual option. I don't know if it's going to feel personable. However, once people try it, they realize that it's actually a lot more comfortable and a lot easier than what they think.
Enjoying our conversations with Dr. Teresa Imholt. She's the Associate Chief of Staff for Mental Health in the Fargo VA system. Sean Abbas, he's the Public Affairs Officer for the Fargo VA. Sarah Kemp Tabbitt, she's a Communication Engagement and Partnerships Coordinator here at the Fargo VA. With the groundbreaking of the new facility, Does that mean more staff now will become available for veterans?
Yes, we continue to grow our staff, and we've actually added in the past 2 years, we've added over 30 mental health staff across our catchment area. So we've added staff in Minot, we've added staff here in Fargo, Grand Forks. The goal is to be able to offer services where the veterans are at. However, sometimes difficult to get a full team at each one of these sites. Maybe we don't need that many providers. So that's where here our kind of hub in Fargo comes in, where our providers are located here, but then provide care out to the community. One of the things that was recognized many years ago, even before I came here to Fargo, was that we needed more for mental health services at this facility. And a new mental health building was initiated a number of years ago by Congress. They said, yes, the Fargo VA needs an appropriation. They need money to build a new mental health building. So that those funds were actually appropriated by Congress for us here in Fargo to build this building. And we are building the building here on our main medical campus. However, the building will be separate from our main medical towers where our inpatient is located. So our new building is actually separate from our main medical center.
Is the need for mental health services diminishing or is it increasing?
It's definitely increasing.
Why is that? Do we know?
Yes, we do. This past year, there was a huge study done by the National Office for VA. And what they're recognizing is that veterans who are younger are seeking mental health services at a much, much higher rate than our veterans who are a little bit older. And so we anticipate that even though our Fargo catchment area might decrease in terms of the number of veterans who live here, the mental health need is actually going to increase over the next few years. And we are working to meet those needs, and this new building will help us succeed in that.
Sarah, with your community responsibilities, what's upcoming? Where can veterans maybe, they don't want to come here to the Fargo mm-hmm. office, where can they maybe go to get more information?
Absolutely. So one of the things we've got coming up, just this Wednesday, we have a community veterans stand down in Broadway Square, downtown Fargo, from 10 to 3. Veterans can go and learn about the services for which they might be eligible. We'll have a vendor booth at Be the Voice event in Thief River Falls on Thursday night from 4:30 to 6:30. My co-worker Andrea will be there in order to provide resources to veterans in the community about VA healthcare. We have, on September 30th, we are participating in a Rural Veteran Suicide Prevention Summit in Minot from 8 to 5. I'll be speaking on some statistics as it pertains to rural veteran mental health and suicide, and then there will be plenty of other people there to provide information and sessions relating to rural veteran mental health and suicide.
Starting in October, we will also have a few events through the public library system here in Fargo, and we will be presenting our masks, which has been a huge therapeutic program for us.
Tell me what that is.
Yeah, our mask project is a combination of treatment, so therapy, through art, where people are able to create a mask that represents maybe the trauma or the experience that they had during their time in the military. And it's really been a huge asset to many people in their recovery and treatment journey.
Sarah, what's the Governor's Challenge?
So the Governor's Challenge is a multi-sector partnership. North Dakota CARES is the lead agency here in North Dakota, but the Fargo VA, the North Dakota Department of Veterans Affairs, the North Dakota Department of Health and Human Services, North Dakota Suicide Prevention Coalition, we have American Foundation for Suicide Prevention, we have First Link, we have ND Hopes, so many organizations all dedicated to one mission, which is preventing suicide among service members, veterans, and their families. We actually have, I would say at this point, kind of quarterly meetings, but we're really more action-oriented than anything. So we have three priority areas that we work on. The first is identifying our service members, veterans, and families, where they live, work, and thrive, and screening for suicide risk. The second is promoting connectedness among those SMVF and connecting them to their resources. And then the third is reducing access to lethal means and safety planning. And so,
how do you look at yourself and understand that you're moving in the right direction with the mental health services that you provide? How do you know you're doing your best and what else there is to do?
A lot of times it really comes in how people relate to others. So how are improvements coming in family dynamics, in family relationships? Maybe people, coworkers, start to notice, hey, you're doing a little bit better, or you're not so moody anymore. Sometimes it really just comes down to you're able to sleep better at night, or other symptoms you personally notice that your mood is a little bit higher. So those might be some signs that people themselves are doing better. In addition, here at the Fargo VA, we provide what we call evidence-based psychotherapy. And part of our evidence-based psychotherapies means really monitoring symptoms. And so we have people take kind of little tests, for lack of a better word, during their time in treatment. And these are objective ways for us to kind of track symptoms and say, hey, so you came in and you had these symptoms when you started, and now 3, 4, 5 weeks later, these are your symptoms that you're experiencing, or you're experiencing them less. And so it really is that kind of personal feedback from that person on how different things in their life are different or maybe improved.
When you say test again, that might be a red flag for someone saying, I'm not coming in, I'm not going to take a test. The whole idea is you're going to help a person in their time of need, guaranteed.
Absolutely.
The other thing I wonder about is if I've noticed my mom or my dad or my wife or my husband has started to change, maybe is impacted by some issues that I attribute to being mental health problems or concerns, and I've visited with them about it and they've told me to go take a hike, but I'm still concerned, should I still reach out to the VA?
Yes,
how absolutely. How can that happen?
So it's a little bit more difficult when the veteran doesn't want to participate in treatment. However, we do have programs through our caregiver support program, which can provide assistance to people who might be in a caregiving role.
And I would add that the Veterans Crisis Line is available 24/7, by dialing 988-PRESS-1, chatting at veteranscrisisline.net, or texting 838-255. If you've got a loved one that's a veteran and you're concerned about them, you can utilize the Veterans Crisis Line.
I think
that
that's
well.
Worth repeating. You don't have to be a veteran.
Don't have
to
be.
Concerned about a friend, a relative, anyone who is a veteran, or anyone, quite frankly, at all, with 988, don't hesitate to call. What are the long-term objectives? You've got a new building underway now. What more is there to do?
There's always more to do. And until we are at zero suicides, there will always be more to do. And so I would say, continuing to provide care, continuing to be available, continuing to provide options as people make choices in their recovery journey and decide, hey, this is what I want, this is what I need, and come in for services.
Dr. Mold, I just want you to talk to the public in general. If you know that somebody is getting mental health services, how important is it for you to support them?
I would say the biggest thing for support is allowing people space to grow, making sure that employers allow any person who is going through a mental health journey time off to attend appointments. I think that that's sometimes a challenge. People say, well, I can't come in, I can't seek services because it conflicts with my work schedule, I'm not able to get off of work. However, that person will be a better employee, a better partner, a better everything if they get the services that they need.
Anything to add, Sarah?
I would absolutely agree. As a friend or a family member, we can let people know that we care about them and that we are here for them. And that recovery is not linear. They might feel great for a couple days and not great for another couple days. And just because they maybe feel like they've had a setback in their recovery doesn't mean that they aren't worthy of that treatment, they aren't worthy of that help. And so just, again, supporting people through that recovery journey, no matter what it looks like to them.
We're really excited for the groundbreaking that it just occurred and look forward to the building probably being done late 2025, so probably December or so, and then some time for us to get everything moved in and start seeing patients, hopefully spring of 2026.
Great Christmas present for the community.
Absolutely.
But that's not to say that the services aren't available currently.
Correct.
So we do have all the services available currently, and we still encourage veterans to come here.
Sean Abbas is the Public Affairs Officer at the Fargo VA Healthcare System. Dr. Teresa Emholt is the Associate Chief of Staff for Mental Health. And Sarah Kemp Tabbitt is the Community Engagement and Partnerships Coordinator here at Fargo VA. To all of you, thank you for joining us on Main Street.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
After the break, my former colleague Ashley Thornburg visits with author Brian Freeman about his new book, Break Every Rule. There's much more to come. Keep the dial where it is and stay with us right here on Main Street.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by BNC National Bank, committed to building vibrant neighborhoods through support of civic organizations, arts and cultural programming, and youth activities. Learn more at bnc.bank.
Welcome back to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm your host, Craig Blumenschein, and joining us again is Brian Freeman. Today, he's here to dive into his latest thriller, Break Every Rule. Brian is in conversation with my former colleague, Ashley Thornburg.
Brian, welcome back to Main Street.
Thank you so much. It's great to be back here.
How do you describe Break Every Rule?
Break Every Rule is a book with a hero, Tommy Miller, that I was deliberately trying to pull from sort of the two halves of my career, because on one hand, I write the Jason Bourne novels, which are very action heavy and you know, very sort of dramatic and suspenseful. And on the other side, I write my Jonathan Stride police procedurals, which are sort of gritty detective novels. And I wanted to create a hero that kind of combined the qualities of both of those characters. And so I sort of say it's Bourne meets Stride. And I personally love how it came together in Tommy Miller. He can do the fight scenes up there with Jason Bourne, and yet he's also a very smart ex-cop that knows how to put together the pieces of a puzzle.
Tommy Miller is this guy. He has been hiding in Florida, living under a false identity because of, like you said, the things that he's done in his past. He turns up being on the run from terrorists. Maybe the government is after him. Maybe, maybe not. His wife and daughter abducted. And so it would seem like it's very obvious that something he did in his past is what brought that into being. Not necessarily the case. You deal with multiple layers of secrets in this book. Before we even get into what draws you to that, how do you keep track of when there's a cross and a double cross and someone's telling a secret and then someone else is telling a different secret?
Yeah, I used to outline all my books exhaustively, and I'd write these very, very long chapter by chapter outlines. But these days, I actually do a lot less of that. I'll still outline the book, but I also love the spontaneity of you know, writing as the day comes and watching how the characters and the plot take shape on the page. And so, a lot of times, the characters and the twists and turns actually surprise me a little bit as I'm going through the book. And sometimes I have to stop and say, "Whoa, did I just break something that I did earlier in the book? Because I didn't see that twist coming."
Why are you so drawn to secrets and past lives catching up with us?
Oh yeah, that is something that you know kind of comes up again and again in my books. In fact, I always used to say about setting the Stride novels in Duluth, Minnesota, was that Duluth was big enough that you could imagine some dark things happening there, but small enough that you always felt like you were bumping into your past around every corner, and that was sort of what happened again and again with Stride in the books is he was constantly sort of bumping into people and stories and themes and problems that emerged out of his past. Not surprisingly, that seems to come up a lot in Jason Bourne's case as well when he's dealing with secrets out of his forgotten past. So I just think there's something inherently interesting and dramatic about that. We always want to know what was really going on and the things that we can't see. And what's fun about a mystery and a thriller is that you have the opportunity to sort of answer those questions for the reader and give them a degree of resolution that a lot of times they don't get when they're dealing with mysteries that come up in the daily paper.
I've spoken with you a few times over the years because you seem to write books in your sleep and you come out with two or three seemingly at a time here. We've spoken in the past about many of the Jason Bourne novels that you have worked on and then some of the Jonathan Stride ones and now books like this. And without fail, the heroes in your book are always somewhat conflicted. Like, they're not even sure if they're good guys and bad guys. In this case, you have a bad guy in the book who, I mean, I think it's fair to say is just a bad guy and seems to be largely drawn maybe by Jeffrey Epstein here and doing work in trafficking. Why even introduce the possibility that the people going after him might not be all good if it seems like it's okay that the other people maybe are all bad?
Yeah, I always say that I don't typically write about superheroes or supervillains. I like all of my characters to have shades of gray in them. And in many cases, in the books, you'll find a degree of sympathy even for some of the characters that do the worst things. And many times what you'll see is an evolution in the character during the course of the book, that they will sort of move from one, you know, stage in their moral development to someplace totally different by the time you get to the end of the book. There's certainly no way around it. There is a character in this book who's largely dark and evil, does not have a whole lot of compensating factors. And yet, for me, he's sort of the lesser important character in the book, and really the character that I like to spend time with and that I think fascinates me in the book is his daughter, who is named Malia. And I think what I love about Malia as a character is exactly the moral journey that she takes throughout the course of the novel, because I think she starts out with sort of this you know black and white view of the world and sort of a degree of willful blindness about the nature of who her father is, and then slowly as the novel unfolds, she begins to discover that she's part of a world that is very different and much darker than she imagined, and it sort of begins to totally change who she is as a person, and that's the kind of character growth that I love to create in my books. So while Tommy Miller is the hero of the book, I think for me the character that sort of really symbolizes everything about Break Every Rule is Malia, because of the way you see that character evolve.
Feel free to finesse these definitions, as you are obviously the author in this conversation, but there is something called the hero's journey and something called the heroine's journey. And the hero's journey, oversimplifying here, tends to be, you know, a little bit more overcoming your physical environment with big feats of strength and courage. And the heroine's journey, far more often, a little bit more deeper, more psychological, more based on identity. Talk a little bit about the weaving of the hero's and the heroine's journey, specific to Break Every Rule.
Yeah, I think that that's probably less true in my novels than you would find in other people's novels. For one thing, in many cases, in some of my other books, I actually will write in a female first person narration, and then I've got characters like Bourne, like Stride, like Tommy Miller that I think their emotional attachments and their relationships are really sort of the key to their identities. And you know, you even look at a character like Bourne, who is you know, sort of this spy and this killer. At the same time, I think what keeps him so interesting as a character in my books is the extent to which he needs to have a relationship in his life to sort of make him a whole person. And I think that's what you find with Tommy Miller as well. I mean, ultimately, you know, what drives Tommy Miller is not any kind of fear for his past. And when it comes to his skills and his background, he's very reluctant to go back into that world. But what's driving him here is his passion for his wife and his daughter, and recognizing what a special woman he has had in his life, and realizing that he really did not know a lot about her. He didn't really know the secrets that she was keeping, and I think it's sort of a humanizing and sort of a little bit of a comeuppance for Tommy that he's been so focused on the nature of his past and his secrets and the things that he's running from, that he was a little blind to the idea that in fact his wife was running from something just as terrifying. And so a large part of his search for them is forcing him to explore who his wife really is and where she came from, and learning the secrets that she was keeping that ultimately, I think, you know, pulls them even closer together.
Do you think it is possible to give a short answer to a question like, what makes up a person's identity? And I ask this because we've spoken many times over the years about how much of your memory is related to your identity, how much of what you do is who you are. And if we are keeping secrets, but those secrets are to protect somebody else, or because they're a version of ourselves that really doesn't exist anymore, you know, are we still that same person? Is there an easy answer to what makes up a person's identity?
Well, you've interviewed me enough times that I think you recognize that I don't think I ever answer with a short answer. And I usually go off on all sorts of tangents along the way. You know, I think I think that ultimately you can summarize identity, because I think it gets down to what do we choose to do in a given situation and what choices do we make in a given situation. I mean, ultimately, that I think really is the essence of our identity, is how do we deal with people, and how do we deal with the challenges and setbacks and opportunities that we face in life, and do we go down path A, or do we go down path B, and ultimately those choices are what define who we are. What makes it more complicated, obviously, is that we don't always make the right choices, and then it becomes a question of how do we use the mistakes of our past to inform us about the future, and can we become better people, and can we live with the mistakes we've made in the past? I think that's what Tommy Miller is dealing with, is feeling that he's made a lot of mistakes in his past, and he's trying to build something new out of it. A very interesting and complicated wrinkle for a character like Jason Bourne, who doesn't have a memory of the past to be able to sort of draw on, and he has to make decisions and choices in life based on sort of a mist that's out there. He simply sort of has to use his instincts about what is right, as opposed to sort of building on what's come up in his life, and that's what other characters and other people have a chance to do.
Learning from our mistakes and using that to inform behavior going forward, not even easy to do on paper with a fictional character, even harder to do in real life. How often, Brian Freeman, are you practicing this in your own life?
Oh my gosh. I think my answer to that has probably evolved over the years, because I think if you'd asked me years ago, you know, if you could go back into your past and change things and correct the mistakes that you've made, would you do it? I probably would have sort of by instinct answered, well, sure, of course, I would want to go back and change the mistakes I made. And yet, as you get older, you begin to realize that it is all of the all of the choices you've made and the good things you've done and the bad things you've done that define who you are and lead you to that point in your life. And if you go back and start to pull one thread on your past, you just don't know how you're going to unravel other parts of your life. I wrote a book a few years ago called Infinite, which was the most unusual book I've ever written because it almost grazes on the edge of sci-fi, and it deals with that concept of parallel universes and people exploring other worlds, other lives. And yet at its heart, it really is a story of redemption, because it gets back to that basic question. You've got a hero named Dylan Moran who has made a lot of mistakes in his life and has lost something precious to him as a result. Mm-hmm. And really it's a question of, can he find a way back to where he was, and can he sort of reclaim himself and his life despite those mistakes? And again, I think that's what we all face, and so we have to sort of, for me, I'm now at a point of feeling that, well, I'm the collection of everything good and bad I've done in my life, and hopefully that's led me to a better place along the way.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm your guest interviewer today, Ashley Thornburg. We are visiting today with Brian Freeman about his new novel, Break Every Rule. Brian, your Jason Bourne novels, he has been in China, he's been in Russia, he's been in France. Your Jonathan Stride novels, primarily based in Duluth, so you are working very much in kind of the Minnesota North Woods, where several of your other books are set. This book is in Florida and the Bahamas, and there's some couple scenes here and there in different places. How do you, as a writer, get a sense of place that you can pass on to your readers?
Well, I think that a setting is very, very important to thrillers, because I think it adds an entire layer of drama around what's going on the page. So I'm always looking to find a setting for each chapter that enhances the drama that's going on for the characters. And for me, I will say I have this strange tendency to choose places that I have visited and areas that I love and then make terrible things happen there. So I will always tell readers, that I like to set my books in places that I love. And usually there will be some wag in the audience who will raise their hand and say, oh my gosh, what do you say about the places that you don't like? But I think that for me, place, it's I call it the six senses of place, because on one hand I want to capture all of the feelings of what it's like to be in a place, I want to capture what it what you see and what you hear and what you feel and what you touch. But there's sort of an overlay beyond that. I also, when I'm talking about a particular setting, I want to capture the emotions that place generates and the memories that place conveys into the character's mind, so that it can convey that into the reader's mind as well. Because place is so much more than just the physical aspects of what we see. It's what does it do to our mind, and what do we remember, and how does it make it feel, and what emotions does a place evoke? If I can capture that in the essence of the thriller, then it's going to really make the reader feel as if they've been dropped down into every scene like an invisible observer, and they can feel that whole essence of the scene taking place around them.
There's a lot of action in this book that takes place in the open waters. We're talking an area here between Florida and the Bahamas, and then of course the Bahamas, a chain of islands, and that's where all of the bad behavior, the people who are trafficking in these young women and the people who are abusing these young women are able to operate. Why did you want to pick an island, or was it the water that drew you to placing it here?
Well, there's a couple things there. I mean, one, on a personal side, Marcia and I, about a year and a half ago, after decades and decades in Minnesota, we concluded that our bodies would probably thrive a little bit more in a warmer climate. And so we relocated to Florida. And so Break Every Rule was, in fact, the first novel that I wrote completely down in Florida, and wrote most of it, in fact, sitting out on a table outside on the lanai. So I love being able to write outside in the fresh air. So it sort of naturally flowed to be able to write a novel that was both based in Florida and based on the water and connected to the Bahamas. The second part of that, of course, is that I like to write books that feel ripped from the headlines and that have a topicality to them that people will sort of immediately be able to kind of make the connections and realize that this is being inspired by things that they've been, you know, reading about in the paper and listening to on the radio. And so clearly one of the big stories in the last few years has been, you know, Jeffrey Epstein and this sort of mysterious island that he had where all of these, you know, dark things were happening. And so I was certainly inspired by that theme and so opted to use something a little bit similar in Break Every Rule, even though the nature of how it comes together is of course very different.
The title of the book is Break Every Rule, and I'm reading here from a write-up about the book. Tommy Miller, his search for answers soon puts him on the wrong side of the law, hunted by the police and pursued by men who want him dead. Worst of all, if he hopes to save Teresa and their daughter Rosalita, he must become the man he once was, a killer operating from the deepest shadows. But when the lives of the people you love are at stake, rules are meant to be broken. Is that true?
Oh, I think that's absolutely true. And I think going back to your question about the nature of the hero's journey versus the heroine's journey, I think that if you talk to men and ask them about a code they would have in their lives, I think most men would say that when it comes to their family, they would never let rules stand in the way of you know, saving their family from danger. I mean, I think that when it comes to for a man, when it comes to your wife, when it comes to your children, I think that everything goes out the window and everything is on the table if it means saving them. I told the folks at Blackstone, in fact, I put it on the title page along with the title of the book, that the first rule in defending your family is break every rule, because I think ultimately that's the way men feel about their family.
That's Brian Freeman with my former co-host, Ashley Thornburg. His book, Break Every Rule, is now on sale.
Tour the studios of some of Fargo-Moorhead's most popular artists during the FM Visual Artist Studio Crawl. This free event is October 5th and 6th, noon to 6 p.m. See new and returning artists demonstrating their work. New destinations this year include the Indigenous Art Collaboration at the Plains Art Museum, and the Rourke Art Gallery is offering tours of their public access print studio and hosting several area artists in their courtyard outside. Find the Studio Crawl map at prairiepublic.org/community.
This is Dakota Datebook for September 10th. Durum wheat was imported from Russia and first cultivated in North Dakota in the 1890s. The North Dakota Experimental Station recognized the benefits of durum and encouraged farmers to plant more of it. Durum wheat yields more bushels per acre and is more resistant to drought compared to other types. It's also the hardest of all wheats, which means it has a high protein content and strong gluten, making it the preferred choice for premium pasta. Initially, consumers were cautious about this new strain of wheat. The gluten composition made it less suitable for baking bread, and since more North Dakotans were baking bread than making pasta, durum was slow to gain popularity. But in June of 1909, a meeting of grain growers in Fargo passed a resolution requesting the establishment of an annual day to promote durum. Governor Burke agreed, setting as a model California's Raisin Day, which encouraged citizens to use raisins to support the raisin industry. Burke was confident that North Dakotans would rise to the challenge and that every patriotic citizen would find ways to incorporate durum into their meals on Durum Wheat Day. Newspapers across the state supported the promotion. Despite this, Mills paid less for Durham compared to other varieties due to the lack of public support. The Ward County Independent pointed out that people should not hesitate to include Durham wheat in their diets, noting that they were already consuming more Durham than they realized, as it was mixed with other types of wheat during milling. On this date, in 1909, the Bottineau Courant published the Governor's Proclamation urging people to give Durham wheat a chance. He named October 7th Durham Day and encouraged North Dakotans to observe the day by hosting church socials and community suppers featuring dishes made with Durham wheat. Today, Durham remains an important part of North Dakota agriculture, with the state producing about 80% of the nation's Durham wheat. Today's Dakota Datebook, written by Dr. Carol Butcher. I'm Ann Alquist.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
That concludes today's episode of Main Street. Thank you for tuning in with us. Looking ahead to tomorrow's show, we'll be joined by our esteemed presidential historian, Dr. Michael Patrick Cullinane from Dickinson State University. We'll reflect on the presidential debate. Also, a quick programming note, tune in tonight for the ABC News Presidential Debate simulcast by NPR. That starts at 8 p.m. Central, 7 p.m. Mountain, right here on Prairie Public. We're eager to be back with you again tomorrow, right here on Main Street.